For over 40 years, Anthony Daniels has owned the role of C-3PO, human-cyborg relations, in the epic Star Wars saga. And now, with the final chapter, The Rise of Skywalker, approaching this December, he has written a memoir, cleverly titled, I Am C-3PO, The Inside Story. Anthony Daniels, welcome.
I'm not sure it's cleverly titled, but it's the title.
You're the only character to appear in every Star Wars film.
The only actor to appear in every Star Wars film, to work on every film, because, you know, quite a few characters do make it through the saga. But as a performer, yeah, amazing. Yeah.
And you spoke the first line of the entire thing.
Yes, I did. Do you remember what it is? Do people at home remember what it is? Okay, you've got 10 seconds. 9, 8, 7, six.
They've shut down the main reactors. Oh.
Now, that's not the first line.
No, it's not, but it's in there.
It's close. Did you hear that? They shut down the main reactor. We'll be destroyed for sure. There'll be no escape for the princess this time. I think that's it. People at home are checking.
Yeah, exactly. I hear your voice and I'm 7 years old again. Thank you. Thank you for being here.
It happens to people. It's odd that the voice, even a little jet lag like today, there's something in there that I can't quite explain.
You've been on magazine covers. You've been a breakfast cereal. You've been parodied by Mel Brooks, and you've even appeared on the Donnie and Marie show.
Yes, not many people can say that, can they?
No, that's
or admit to it, shall we say.
After looking back on all of this, how does everything feel?
Well, it's strange. It's going to take a few years to get a perspective on it, frankly, because when you're involved in something so big, it comes to me that you can't really have detachment from it until maybe some years has passed. So I'm kind of waiting for that distance to grow and for it to become a kind of a big object that I can actually take in that size. Right now, you know, people say, what's it like to be in all? I don't know. I'm in them. It's enough. I'm involved. I'm deeply involved. So one day I'll go, I see. Yes.
Why did you wait until now to write the book?
I had thought about it from time to time over the years, but basically being lazy, I couldn't be bothered. It's a ton of work. You know, anybody out there who's written a book, it's taken a bit of an effort. But really, the honest answer is that they asked me if I would like to write a book. And as we approach the third ending of the third trilogy, or the ending of the third trilogy, because I've been around for the end of the first trilogy, the second trilogy, and now the third, and the closure of the saga of Luke Skywalker's family in The Rise of Skywalker, it seemed an apt moment. It seemed, you know, here is a beginning, a middle, and, as they say, an end.
And it seems a bit prophetic because, as you said, there was the end of the first trilogy, and that seemed to be the end.
Oh, yeah, absolutely.
And then the end of the second trilogy.
Yeah, and sad farewells and all that. But now the sad farewell was quite moving, actually.
The book travels chronologically through your career as C-3PO.
I suppose it does, because what in determining how to actually lay out the book, almost physically, well, physically, yes, it seemed to me that I had a ready-made coat rail, if you will, and there are coat hangers on it. And I realized that the markers really are those films in the order in which they were shot, which people will remember was 4, 5, 6, 1, 2, 3, 7, 8, 9. It's like some terrible maths question, you know, if it takes three men 2 days with five shovels to dig a hole sort of thing. But upon that sort of coat rack, I wanted to place other stories, other insights into sort of ancillary subjects around it, you know, whether it's talking about John Williams' just astounding music, or whether it's about the terrible art of forging signature and ripping fans off, or whether it's about fans who love to dress up in stormtrooper outfits and make live events really spectacular. There's all sorts of things, including the Donnie Marie Osmond show, that have their place hanging almost like decorations around a Christmas tree.
And you mentioned fans that are willing to stand in a deluge of rain for hours, if not days at a time, just to celebrate the story that is Star Wars.
Yes, many years ago, there was this thing called Celebration. The Lucasfilm came up with the concept that there would be, to launch Episode One, way back in time, a fan gathering. And people can read about what an exciting and wonderful and thrilling and touching and moving event that was, because there were horrible events happening around it. And even remembering it, to write about it, it was a very moving experience. But also talking about the tenacity and the affection and the energy that fans have put in. And when I say fans, you know, I'm not talking about crazy people. I'm talking about people who developed an affection for the story that George Lucas created. Not crazy fans at all, just people who took the story to themselves, making it almost a backbone to their family's cultural life, if you will, a story to share, you know, dark side or not, you know, hero or robot. There's something for everybody.
There are many archetypical roles throughout the entire saga. Of the many things that I learned through reading your book, one thing that really stuck out in my mind, you seem to be the hardest working member of the cast, particularly during the first film. You suffered so many indignities, particularly in the deserts of Tunisia, through the heat and the cold. And you just seem to have struggles dealing with the costume that is C-3PO.
Yeah, the costume was not great. It wasn't really finished when we started filming. And they tried really hard. But, you know, there was lots of other things to do to make that film look the way it looks to this day. And yes, my own personal little nightmare was kind of on a daily basis. But of course, you know, lots of people had to work really, really hard in movies. It's a curiously challenging profession. It's wonderful. It is absolutely wonderful. But it's a job. And one of the things, you know, you do need tenacity to put up with things, to endure and whatever. And I wasn't always the most patient person. But, you know, as we come to filming The Rise of Skywalker, which I can talk about, I do talk about in very roundabout terms, because I'm not going to spoil anything.
Nor would I want you to.
No, you know, sensible people don't want it spoiled. But when I look at, for instance, how Daisy Ridley just is so good actor, but the physical stuff she puts in, wow. Now, huge respect there. She works really hard, as John Boyega, Oscar Isaac. Everybody really has to put in a lot. Just back in the day, 1976, when we were filming, yes, I didn't know I was going to have to put that much in. But it gets worth it in the end.
You make reference to a couple of moments where you maybe felt a little trapped in the suit. Something would happen and you're, get me out, get me out. Did you experience claustrophobia?
I did at one point, and again, it's in the book, and it was really quite startling to have something that comes from nowhere, came from nowhere, and over which you have no control. It's that panic button that got pressed, and I don't know why. I got over it. I made myself get over it. You know, getting back on a horse, isn't it?
So the first film, episode 4, wraps. You're not quite sure what happens next, and you're made aware of the phenomenon that it becomes sort of secondhand. You are not quite given the recognition that, say, the other members of the cast are, because you're hidden behind the mask of C-3PO. And that seemed to be a difficult challenge for you to deal with for a while.
It was very difficult because, you know, we talked about hard work just now, and I'd certainly put my bit in the movie. And then, yes, 3PO actually had the biggest part of all of them, had more lines than anybody to say, but nobody was really allowed to know I was saying them. And that was a curious thing because I didn't really understand. I thought, you know, I should have been there, but I wasn't. And that was quite difficult to live through, but I did live through it. And by accepting the second movie, I kind of accepted that I, again, might be slightly anonymous. But of course, by then, my name was on the poster, which kind of, sort of sounds a little petty, maybe, you know, name on your poster, what does it mean? Your mother's going to like it, you know, but that's about it, really. But it wasn't an acknowledgement that I was indeed a full member of the cast, whether you could see my face or not.
And when you had 3PO's footprints placed in the cement at Man's Chinese Theater, you, maybe a little graffiti-like, wrote your own name along.
No, it was all established before I strutted out in 3PO's costume. No, I did say that, you know, I really, if I was going to do this, I wanted a cement acknowledgement. Yeah. It's still there, my name. Amazing.
I'd like to ask you a little bit about the relationship that I found very curious is your relationship to 3PO himself. There's a wonderful passage in the book. I believe it's on page 142. If you wouldn't mind, I'd like to ask you to read that for me.
All right. Okay. I'd grown to admire his innate loyalty, a quality I admire in humans, so maybe I was able to relate and play it up a little. But unlike me, the poor creature has no sense of humor. which actually makes him quite funny to watch. He is the ultimate straight man. The fact that he finds human behaviour hard to understand is key to some of his anxieties. Humour and irony are essential to survive living on any planet I know. Without them, 3PO is indeed doomed to suffer. That's so, you know, we're doomed to suffer. We're doomed. We're made to suffer. That's it. We're made to suffer. It's our lot in life. And it's genuine because he has no sense of irony, which does make him quite funny, I think. So, and that was really in George's original writing. Well, it was all in George's original writing. One of the things I loved about the script that I was given had nothing to do with me, but reading the lines, I felt I just got this character because he was humorless. He had no sense of really the intricacies of human interaction. So he was often puzzled by what was going on. He didn't like what was going on because it was noisy and dangerous. It was written in a lovely way. And that's why I wanted to play him in the end.
And as much as he hated space travel, he seemed to always be on some sort of space travel.
I know. It's full of wry instances for his life cycle. He's always somewhere he shouldn't be. He's always being put down, ignored, taken advantage of, whatever, bullied. And he really is a kind of classic common man theme, which is what George originally wanted. That here is a nobody. He's a Mr. Nobody, and therefore we can relate to him because basically most of us are nobodies. We get on with it, but it's difficult sometimes. But that's why we can relate to him, because we share his burdens, if you like.
Lastly, speaking of relationships, I'd like to talk just a bit about the relationship between 3PO and R2-D2. They're one of the classic duos in the same vein as Abbott and Costello, or Ralph Cramden, Ed Norton, Fred Flintstone, Barney Rubble, this pairing of opposites that just seems to make each other better.
You know, there's a film, The Odd Couple. That's a classic on-screen moment. But if you have two characters with different personalities that slightly key into each other, you have a ready-made constant ability to comment for the audience who are kind of voyeuristically listening. And again, the relationship was there on paper when I first opened that script. What I didn't know, and hear this, because it is extraordinary looking back, that nobody in the 6 months of preparing me for the suit and all that kind of thing, with me reading each iteration of the script over and over again, nobody thought to say, you know, when it says 3PO says this and R2 says that and 3PO replies and R2 beeps that, there's going to be no sound. It's just you talking. There's going to be no beeps. They're put on afterwards. So can you just talk to yourself? Nobody thought to tell me that, which is very weird, isn't it? So fortunately, on day one, I didn't actually have any dialogue. I had one or two lines, which was like, oh. But after that, you know, wandering about the desert, yeah. And then I had to really work at listening intelligently to something that wasn't speaking. Because it's not just staring and waiting for your cue, your next line, leaving a pause. No, it's reacting to lines that you are playing in your head. And therefore, when I saw the film, you know, how many months later, and seeing this dialogue that Ben Burtt created after the fact, it was magic and so realistic, so realistic. He won an Oscar for that.
Another thing I'd like to ask you about, aside from the Star Wars movies, you took part in Star Wars radio dramas through National Public Radio.
Oh, yes.
Again, one of the only original cast members to voice their character.
Yes, certainly by the time we got to Return of the Jedi, yeah. And my first job was in radio with the BBC. I just think it's a magic medium and it doesn't work so well anymore. It's all music now on radio. But radio drama, it's when people ask me about acting on green screen, you know, radio is green screen acting because you've got a script and you've got the walls of a studio and in your head you're playing that scene out. So in a way, green screen acting is like radio. It's more fun if you have big scenery things around you because it's like, wow, look at that. How amazing. But the NPR, yeah, that was well worth doing. And I'm pretty happy with that. And I do talk about that in the book because you had really quite famous names from the past. You know, Ed Asner as Jabba the Hutt. You know, how well we remember him. John Lithgow, I think, as Yoda. And there was me locked because there's a slight treatment on my voice for sound, which is a tiny, what we call delay, so it's a tiny echo, but it means I have to be separated in a glass booth in this case. And really, it does again speak to the kind of isolation of playing a character like that, not only on set being locked away inside the suit, but even when you're doing radio, you've got to be locked away. But at least I could see all around me through the glass booth. And it was very popular, and I was proud to talk about it, you know.
Towards the end of the book, you make reference to an exhibit of Star Wars artifacts. This, again, speaks to that relationship that I feel that you have with the character C-3PO. You found his self, the C-3PO outfit, on display, but it wasn't quite right. The elbows and the knees and parts were just missing. So you, you did a little guerrilla repair.
Well, I'm quite a practical person, you know. One of the things I loved about being on the original Star Wars was I discovered gaffer tape, which is like duct tape, but even better. And really, life, you can't live without a roll of that somewhere. And yes, I did look at this exhibit and, you know, the multi-million dollar exhibits going around the world. And I was really shocked that people had just left black space. So when no one was looking, you know, I looked after my friend. Yeah, he'd do the same for me, I think.
I'm so grateful for your time with me today. This has been a once-in-a-lifetime experience. Before you go, there's one last thing I want to ask you about. At the time that Star Wars was first created and first entered popular culture, Kenner Toys, the company responsible for all the action figures, was based here in Cincinnati. And so I'm curious, what artifacts have you collected over the years of production?
I so remember Kenner Toys. They were superb quality. Absolutely superb. And I used to do a lot of the toy commercials for Grey Advertising, who looked after Kenner Toys. And we had such fun. As far as collecting things, no, I don't. I never have. Don't want things like that. There are things in boxes here and there, but not deliberately collecting. Really, it's just a big Lego sculpture in our sitting room at home that is a kind of pop art version of 3PO. That's the only Star Wars thing you would see. Most people don't know what I do for a living still, you know? But when they see that, oh, yeah, right. So I know people have adored collecting Star Wars stuff over the years, and good on them, because they are keys to creativity and enjoyment and so on. And George's story did touch so many people in so many different ways. And it's clear to me, as I write in the book, that it has become a timeline within families where people can really be quite emotional meeting me and recounting what Star Wars meant to family members who may not be with us anymore, but who are well remembered for the night they went to see the original, for instance.
My guest today has been Anthony Daniels, the actor behind C-3PO on film, on television, and on radio. His book, I Am C-3PO, The Inside Story, is available now, and be sure to catch his final performance as the beloved golden droid in The Rise of Skywalker this December at a theater near you. Anthony Daniels, thank you for making me feel 7 years old again. This has been a pleasure.
Thank you. And may the Force be with you.
For Around Cincinnati, I'm Jim Nolan.